listening to a special podcast from the Pod Delusion. In this lecture, you'll hear Roger Martin from Population Matters give arguably the most controversial talk of the BHA Conference 2012 in Cardiff. The title of the talk was Population Growth, Multiplier of Impacts, Divider of Resources, Provoker of Conflict. To introduce the talk, here is BHA trustee David Pollock.
My name's David Pollock and I'm a trustee of the BHA. And I've not yet been given the signal to start. On the other hand, there's enough of you here, and we are running over time. By way of introduction, I'm just going to recall, for those of us who are of my generation, that back in the 60s, population was right up there on the progressive agenda. BHA in its People First campaign in 1967, the Rationalist Press Association publishing books by Jack Parsons. But for one reason or another, not least of which I think had something to do with the Holy See, it has dropped away from the progressive agenda and disappeared. And as Roger Martin, whom we're going to hear from now, himself has observed, it's now quite often the case that if you even raise the subject, people turn away and don't want to talk about it. Roger Martin has had two careers, as a diplomat, rising to be a Deputy High Commissioner, and then deciding that that was somewhat futile, he decided to get into environmental politics. And he is, in fact, now the Chair of Population Matters. Roger, I'll clap for you.
Thank you very much. There's a lot of guff about me in your packs. I'd like perhaps just to mention where I'm coming from philosophically to start with. Brought up as a devout Anglican, lost my faith and became a humanist at university. Typical 60s idealist, first year VSO volunteer, formative civil rights summer and so on. Became a diplomat in this naive view that people, although nations were driven by self-interest, they applied enlightened self-interest. And I was interested early on in the famous prisoner's dilemma game, where you cooperate twice and then retaliate as the winning strategy. I learnt otherwise, of course. I then, recently, I've started, instead of when they ask me my religion when I go into hospital, I put, instead of humanist, ecoist, which I see as a sort of deeper green and rather more religious variant on humanism. And if I can pick this up and work it, here's a picture of my God, insofar as that's a religion. Many of the feelings which are analogous to those of a conventional religion, awe, wonder, respect, particularly for the smear of life on this planet. That's the God that I worship, as it were, and also, of course, senses of sin and guilt for understanding the laws of biophysics and breaking them in damaging ways. Indeed, the only thing differing, perhaps, from a normal Christian God is the lack of reciprocity. My favorite quote from Archie the Cockroach, if you remember him, of Don Marquis, Generation May, it's an insect's view of life. He said, "I once overheard the survivors of a colony of ants, partially obliterated by a cow's foot, seriously debating the intentions of God towards their society." And my favorite medico-actuarial fact, not opinion, and I do like facts, is life is a sexually transmitted condition which is 100% fatal. The other point about our beautiful little biosphere here hanging on its ball of rock, like a smeared over it, like a film of oil, is that it's finite. The flat earthers it's physically finite, which means that, of course, among other things, that no physical thing can grow indefinitely, which means that population growth and growth in consumption per person will quite definitely end at some point. I could spin you a dozen scenarios for how conventional growth capitalism, consumerism, will end. But there are only two ways, as Greg said earlier, because we've had half this discussion already, there are only two ways in which populations can stop growing. They are sooner the humane way, by contraception, backed by policy and resources, to make it available and empower people and educate people to use it, or later, the natural way by which nature has kept every other species in balance with its habitat over the last 4 billion years, and thus has driven evolution, that is, famine, disease, and predation, or war. But there's no real alternative. Kenneth Boulding, great economist, green economist, gave a speech in 1966. He was President Kennedy's environmental advisor, where he talks about the moving from a cowboy planet to a spaceman economy, from one where the prairies are infinite and throughput of cattle is the measure of success, to the spaceman who wants to end his 5-year voyage wearing exactly the same suit that he was wearing when he set out, and certainly doesn't want lots of hitchhikers joining his craft along the way. The famous joke that he made, which I very often quote because I love economist jokes, is anyone who believes in indefinite growth in anything physical on a physically finite planet is either a madman or an economist. And it's, you hear it, example, I want to say it every morning when I turn on the news and people talk about back to normal growth, sustainable growth, the oxymoronic evidence of the need for education. And when the financial crisis struck, I have to say, I initially thought 3 years ago, probably there's another bounce or even two left in unsustainable global growth capitalism. Now I'm not so sure. Money, I made a deal on Reading Station the other day, which netted me $20 billion. $20 billion, and here they are. Sorry, Bank of Zimbabwe. There they are. Very proud of my 20 billion. In other words, remember that money, when we talk about costs, we're talking increasingly about patterns, states of mind, about patterns of electrons in people's computers, the relationship between real useful stuff like potatoes, you know, is getting increasingly tenuous. Here's a picture of the history of the world. And you've all got that in your packs as well. I slipped a sheet in with our basic policy statement on one side and that picture on the other. But I would draw your attention to the... does it have a light? Perhaps it does. It does. To the age of the world. You know, 5 billion years. Here's the dinosaurs. Very successful creatures, the dinosaurs. They lasted a very long time. Here was the... that bar is this one, apes and men. And here's Homo sapiens, this last little lot. And indeed, this is even shorter. This is agricultural man. Over all this period, as life evolved, there is the oldest rocks and there's the first life form. Nature had the laws, the rather tough laws that we know about. There's no birth control and there's no death control. You know, the fittest survive. And it's interesting that when Darwin, insofar as he had a eureka moment, read Malthus 5 years after the Beagle Voyage, that he had this illumination. The eureka moment said, stuff is always limited, species are always plentiful, they compete for scarce resources, and the luckiest, the fittest, the toughest, the nastiest survive to breed, the others don't, and so that's why we're standing here today. This curve, you've seen, starts rising with the agricultural revolution, the first form of artificial death control. It turns sharply exponential with the industrial revolution. I see that as the time when we became smart enough to use the stored solar energy in those fossil fuels to gobble our way through all the rest of the natural capital laid down over 5 billion years, that huge age when capital was being stored up in the minerals and the forests and the soils, the fisheries, the biodiversity. And we started to use it at great speed. But we remained stupid enough, unfortunately, to think of it as income, and this still haunts us today. The curve has tripled. Look, there's I'm younger than the Queen, but not much younger. The population has tripled in my lifetime. I was a blitz baby. And look at the range projected by the UN for 38 years away. That's for 2050. A range of 2.5 billion people, more or less, depending on what we do about it in the next 38 years. Which is substantially more, 2.5 billion, than the whole population of the planet when I was born. So, you know, anyone who says that this is not a unique period in our history is, alas, fooling themselves. That curve, in fact, surprisingly closely fits the curves of the conventional brown-green algal bloom, and indeed of a lemming migration. And heard already about the exponentiality, but my friend Al Bartlett, a professor in Colorado, believes that the tragedy of our species, the main one, is our failure to grasp the exponential function. And it isn't just... Whoops, do I mean that? I mean that one. I do. Here we are, the Anthropocene, where, you see, all the curves are doing the same thing. Damming rivers, fertilizers, urban populations, paper, McDonald's, motor vehicles, and so on. All the curves are doing that. And it's mostly us doing it. So never let it be thought that population growth is an issue only for poor people. I have to say that we heard about the perfect storm this morning. The perfect storm, this afternoon, comprising, as the chief scientist has said, population growth, climate change, and peak oil, leading to ever greater food, water, and energy insecurity. And that's a physical, a biophysical phenomenon he's talking about, which I think is likely to become dominant against the electronic technologies, which are relatively straightforward. I have to say also that I regretted when you famously put up your very successful bus posters on the London buses 3 years ago or 4 years ago, the second half of it read, there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your lives, or words to that effect, when it should have said, it's time to grow up and take responsibility. And I thank you. I'm quite surprised by that. Thank you very much. Translation into Africa of this. This is actually the UN projection for 2050, for the next 38 years. Look at Nigeria, more than doubling. In particular, I feel for Niger here. Little Niger going from 16, of whom half are on food aid today, and they have a famine looming, to 55 million. I don't think Niger can feed 55 million people, and neither do they, because I was in Difid at a stakeholder group meeting for a big new family planning initiative recently, a worldwide video conference. And the guys from Niger chipped in and said, we've just got remarkable reductions in our fertility from our pilot project of mobile clinics accompanied by husband schools. You get the women to go to the clinic for the depot jab, and you get the men to sit down and learn how much better off they'd all be, and their kids wouldn't die so fast, and they'd be better educated, and they could afford food. With, if your wife spaced her, and how much healthier she would be if she could space her children. So it's not imposing stuff on them. It's not a matter of old, rich, white men like me telling young, poor, black women to have fewer babies and blaming them for their poverty if they don't. They need help, and they're not getting it. I'm jumping ahead of myself. I was in... That, by the way, assumes fertility rates drop. But one of the problems is that when you ask people cold in Nigeria and elsewhere how many babies they want, they say, we want a lot of babies. That's what the girls say, because they've been taught to say it, and their dads say, with a proud macho kind of woof, I want even more. So the husband schools are pretty important, and empowering and educating women is pretty important. I was in Ouagadougou at a conference before Christmas, and I'd never been to West Africa. I must say the tragedy stealing up on the Sahel struck me poignantly, because there are some of the fastest growing populations in the world of herdsmen moving south ahead of the advancing desert with ever larger herds of scrawny cattle, where they're running into the fastest growing populations in the world of farmers still hacking away and degrading the soil, which washes off when it rains. And these two groups come into conflict. The cattle eat the crops, the farmers kill the cattle, the herdsmen raid the farmers. People are dying every day, probably, in these Cain and Abel struggles already along the Sahel. And I mentioned to Polly Higgins in the break that I could not see how this squared with the idea of prosecuting anybody. Ecocide is taking place, but how do you use prosecution? What's the use of that? It's crowded. And it's not just crowded there. This is a train in Bangladesh, so it's crowded there. And it's not even trains in Bangladesh. It's pretty crowded on the tube as well. I'm a tall, so it's my armpit her nose might be thrust into, and I sympathise entirely. This is not helpful. And here's a rather bad graph of projection to 2100, where the top one, at 27 billion people, is what would happen with constant fertility. The high one assumes a high fertility level, but with instant replacement fertility, you still get to 10 billion, and we're not sustaining 7 now. We're merely supporting them by devouring natural capital, and only the low fertility, below replacement fertility variant, gets us down to a possibly a much more sustainable 6. Never forget that demographers, like economists, live in a sort of demographic bubble where they have to assume, for the purposes of their discipline, that the figures they project on the future will have no impact on the biophysical world beyond their computer, and vice versa. So they never factor into these absurd projections sharp increases in mortality following ecological collapse, whereas we know that those are inevitable at some point, those discontinuities. We just don't know when and how. And the same with economics, you know. One can draw exponential curves in the future, but they're all going to stop in a physical world if they relate to anything physical. This is the theory behind that. Here's the IPAT function. Paul Ehrlich, one of our patrons, years ago. Environmental impact times... impact equals population times consumption. That's the key thing. It's one multiplied by the other, like the sides of a rectangle give the area. So never let anyone get away with saying the problem is not population, it's consumption, it's capitalism, it's greed, it's something else. It's always both and all. It's one multiplied by the other. And you'll get different shapes of rectangle in different countries. It is quite true that the rich countries consume vastly more than their share and must somehow be induced to consume a great deal less. Nonetheless, the poor people, the poor countries, who are virtually have a rather low impact at the moment, have a multi-billion dollar aid industry trying to make them rich too, and as they get richer, their footprint will increase. So across the whole range of these things, you get the same old truth coming through. It's no use reducing your footprint if you keep on increasing the number of feet. It's a very simple idea, one multiplied by the other. And of course, it's very, there's vast inequities here, as I've mentioned. Within sustainable limits, if some have more, others will have less, if you want to keep within limits. It really is a finite planet like a finite pizza. One person gets more, somebody else gets less. More people are allowed to share it equally. Smaller a slice each person gets. It's tough, but there it is. It raises a big intergenerational ethic in that, leaving some pizza over for our children is important. What is interesting is that environmental regulation we are totally used to this morning, as we know, and that sole function is to protect the environment from the economy. In other words, the future from the present, from the greed and convenience of the present generation, to protect our kids, to have something viable left. All that applies to pollution, quite rightly, and other things. And the question for the discussion might be, how far can you make that apply to population? Because it's no doubt at all that there's an intergenerational ethical element in two people with two living children deciding to have a third child when they have the choice, and thereby, as a matter of fact, not opinion, ratcheting up the population of the planet, ratcheting up impact on the environment, total human impact, bringing nearer the day of serious ecological failure, and ratcheting down everybody else's share of finite and dwindling natural resources to deal with this. So they will adversely affect everybody else, including their own children, in these three ways, and that raises an ethical issue that they should think about before they take that decision. Population and climate change, correlation is not causation, but it is quite striking that the two march precisely hand in hand, and emissions per head have remained relatively static for a decade in Europe, we are still great criminals because they're vastly higher than other people. One new Brit, extra Brit, is 22 more Malawians. So the 10 million more people that we are forecast to have, the 10 more Birminghams that the ONS think we could have in the next 22 years, by 2033, 10 more Birminghams would be the equivalent of 220 million more Malawians. And we've done some interesting research with the figures on how the, you know, just to stand still in total infrastructure quality would cost over £1 trillion at current costs, and to just stand still in total carbon emissions would require, to sustain that extra 22 million, additional wind turbines equivalent to 27, additional renewables equivalent to 27,000 more wind turbines. So I have a lot of entertaining numbers like that in my head, and I keep getting more from the LSE. And here's the cop-out, the last one, in Durban. You see, the world's on fire, and the firemen are fighting each other. It's both funny, but it's not totally... You know, it's not hard... because these two firemen are the rich and the poor. You know, this is the ethic of inequity. Why should, you know, I not have an air conditioner in Delhi when you've got them all over Colorado? Well, we shouldn't have them in Colorado, but the fact is, oh fellow Indian, if all of you guys put on air cons too, you know, it's going to collapse under you. You know, when you stand in the desert among the bare bones of the dead cattle and you shout at the burning sky, you know, but why shouldn't I? You know, it's not fair. This guy won't answer. This is not the kind of discussion that they have, and it's difficult. All I contribute to it year after year is a lot of stuff saying, whatever your problem, whatever your outcome, it'll be easier the sooner we can stabilise our numbers. Any problem. Equivalent thing on hunger. Food, a very precise correlation between growth in the number of hungry people and population growth rate. Sub-Saharan Africa going off the graph, practically, with higher fertility. Of course, if they could get their fertility right down, stabilise their numbers, they would develop faster, as the All-Party Parliamentary Group has pointed out. But then they would, of course, consume more per head, and who knows whether their carbon footprint would go up or down. I don't, but you can't possibly tell poor people not to try to get richer. The very poor must improve their consumption. And Kofi Annan, to whom I had a real session at a conference 3 years ago in Geneva, put in his key recommendations two important things. He said population stabilisation should be a priority for sustainable development. Ho-ho, I'm going to Rio next week and we'll see if that comes true there. I am not optimistic we'll get anywhere. The second thing he said was about climate change. The principle of contraction and convergence, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where the rich come right down in their carbon emissions, the poor come up, and we converge towards equal fair shares at a sustainable level around the world. Contraction and convergence with a population base year should be the basis for climate equity. And that answers a question raised earlier, I think, in the previous discussion on population. Population base year is very important as the incentive to stabilise your numbers as quickly as possible, and a disincentive to carry on growing, so that you'll have as a nation, as a government, to give smaller and smaller shares to your ever-rising numbers of people. This is, of course, not just a matter of us lot. Here are people in a difficult environment. They deserve our respect. And you know, what we have here is a picture, I think, which could be illustrating what Norman Borlaug said. Should have gone that to the last slide. When he was the father of the Green Revolution. And in his Nobel acceptance speech, he said, unless I've given you a breathing space to stabilise your numbers, if you don't do that, you won't be feeding hungry people more, you'll just be feeding more hungry people. Very much, I think, the situation we're in now. And the last thing these poor women need, of course, is more children, because it wouldn't help. You, for feeding, you need basically soil and water, don't you? And for intensive agriculture, you need oil as well. They haven't got any soil. They haven't got any water. Soil is eroding at frightening speed. When 1960, there was half a hectare of decent arable soil each in the world. It's now down to 0.2 of a hectare. China, it's only 0.1 of a hectare, which is why they're staging this dramatic land grab around Africa. These are worrying, and it's, of course, because of their erosion problems as well as their population growth. These are worrying figures. Water, they haven't got there either. Well, we all know about the Nile and the Mekong and the Euphrates, the kind of international tensions building in the major river basins about dividing up finite water supplies. Less known about is the groundwater. Aquifers are being depleted at great speed across South Asia, China, northern Brazil, Mexico, you name it, where it seems to be a free good, and you've got a Land Rover mounted borehole driller, bzzz, up it comes, irrigate the land, you know, milk for the make the children's bones strong. It's all lovely. I used to lecture on this at northern Gujarat. And then one day, a bit of dirty water, and it stops, and you look at each other. You know, what do you do now? Happening all over the world. Groundwater is quite a conflictual issue. The Ogallala aquifer is going on, is being depleted. That's the big one up the Midwest from Texas. That's being depleted twice as fast as it's being recharged naturally. When I was head of Middle East Department, I don't know, 30 years ago, the Saudis were just getting into, we need agriculture as well. We'd be a proper country. We'll grow our own food because we've got this damn great aquifer coming right down into the Hejaz from the Jordan border. And now they're closing it down again because they've drained all the water. And here's other species, which I think should play a much more prominent role. This is not actually, this is a guesstimate. The guy that did it as a calculation has sort of recanted, so I don't give his name. But it's not a bad guesstimate. One wouldn't be surprised if the sheer weight, the tonnage of mammals on the Earth were 12% of total tonnage in 1750, people and their animals, all the other green ones being wild, and now a different scene. And here's a little cartoon, natural resources. The well is dry, we've got a lot of new customers. I think this is the one which raises with me the problem about the ecological ethic of the third child that I mentioned just now. Clearly, before you decide to have that third child and add to that gusher with the dry well, you should balance out your individual reproductive rights with your social and environmental responsibilities, including to the future generations, including your own kids. That's what we ask people, and they never do, of course. I got this from David King. He's talking to you tomorrow. I look forward very much to that. Last chief scientist. It's a summary. Whatever your problem, there they all are. Population makes it worse. And our dilemma can be expressed in a different cartoon. Here we are. I'm only going to say this one more time. Our only chance is self-control. But we are not bunnies. Aren't we lucky? We have this wonderful technology, family planning, to tackle that problem in a different way. UNICEF said famously years ago, family planning could do more good for more people at less cost than any other known technology. Good stuff. And the fact that 40% of the pregnancies in the world are unintended at the moment makes it, one would have thought, really blindingly obvious that family planning is desirable. Universal access, cheap or free, good quality, good choices, education and incentives to use it, encouragement, empowerment of women, etc. Education for men. It's just blindingly obvious, isn't it? So you think the world would have got the message, and how? What do you think the response is? Here's the response. The response is nil. The response is zilch. The response is need and donor support. There, that little blue line travels along still. Do you know, total world aid for family planning at the moment is less than, almost exactly 10% of the Goldman Sachs bonus pot. Isn't that a lovely figure? Really, a derisory as that. And here's the same thing again. And this is how it's happened. It's happened because of HIV/AIDS, an ethical decision taken by governments to prioritize saving lives. Here's somebody sick with a disease that they will die of. We have these antiretrovirals. We pour in the antiretrovirals. We will save these lives, i.e. prolong these lives, a more accurate term. And look, family planning is the utterly residual... isn't it pathetic? Look at that. That's the decline in family planning. It's dropped off the map. The solution... not the solution to the world's problems, but a necessary condition for the solution of any of the world's problems. Isn't it extraordinary? Well, I bid it to Goldman, sorry. Yep. The question about future starvation is tricky. To put it right, I mean, different estimates about... Nobody knows quite how you change attitudes. But to meet the unmet need for family planning in the form of services and the direct support services around them, not the more tricky, complex, and cultural stuff, would cost about half of what Americans spend every year on Halloween. About $3.5 billion. It's not big stuff, really. So why does it happen? Well, I think I gave the game away with that nice little picture here. It happens because of hysteria. And that hysteria arose with this bizarre coalition, a conspiracy almost, quite unconscious, which formed in the late 1970s, early 80s, between the religious right, led by the Pope. This lady is not very happy, is she? The religious right, the liberal left, and elements in the feminist movement. And there's the religious right. Glad you mentioned that originally, about the power of the papal nuncio in those global negotiations. Stay the course. I could wax lyrical, of course, about the evils of that monstrous doctrine of theirs, but I've long since concluded there's no sense in discussing it politely with Catholics. You just pour loathing and contempt and accusations of the evil they're doing to the world on their heads. How lovely. I've been booed for saying worse than that. I mean, better than that, milder than that. Here's the next one, the liberal left, the taboo. And these are the guys that really worry me, because they're people like me. You know, these are the people exactly the same, you know, out of the environmental movement. Sustainability, agriculture, water, population. Sorry, we don't talk about that. This is very, very common, and it drives me nuts. The liberals assume that it's racist. They assume that it's, as I said, old rich white men blaming young poor black women. No blame at all. A lot of sympathy for those tough women we saw in the Sahara there. The origins of that lie back, I think, with the Cairo Conference. Cairo Conference in 1994, 2 years after the first Rio Conference, was one where they got rid of the entire... population argument completely. They didn't just put women's rights, quite rightly, on top of the rather heavy-handed Malthusian programs and say, bloody hell, you know, you've got to treat women like human beings. You know, stop just, you know, the coercion and the coercive abuses in India were a very bad thing. But they said, don't talk population anymore, that's coercive, just talk SRHR, sexual and reproductive health and women's rights. And the result has been this sort of pathetic collapse in funding and attention and priority. It's very odd. People who do that include a guy I admire and like, George Monbiot. He's completely sort of closed-minded, it would seem. Duncan Green at Oxfam, number two, head of research at Oxfam. Of that generation, my generation, as it were, to have been picked up their attitudes in the late 80s, 90s. And brainwashed. Very, very strange thing. It would reject all this. They just say, it's racist. Or, you know, typical fat people trying to make excuses for themselves. The feminists, I think, the feminists themselves took over at Cairo. That's right. They banned even family planning at one point, and they had this neurotic fear of coercion. And these are the people who now run things. You go to meetings of the UNFPA, it is quite rightly, I would think, primarily women you'll find there. But many of those women will have a very tough view of the language you use. They won't want you to talk about population. They'll want you to stick to the SRHR. And the result is that finance ministers aren't interested, and neither are security ministers or environment or agriculture or industry. It's just a subset of health, the population issue, and that's where you've got to get it out from. The silence you will see in all these big UN negotiations, or from Nagoya on the Biodiversity Convention, from all the climate change talks, from Rio next week and the week after, I fear we're going to see that familiar silence falling on them when it comes to population. So they'll pretend, they'll write these letters to Santa Claus, they'll draw these great pictures of sustainable development, regardless of how many people there are on the earth, and they'll tell the silent lie, which is currently told by the development of the environmental NGOs here, apart from Save the Children, won't mention it. They always imply, I used to run a wildlife trust, you know, constantly pouring stuff out. I'm president of all sorts of things, but out it comes, the literature, we're going to make it all lovely for butterflies, and you know, we're going to make it sustainable. And the development people say we're going to make these people prosperous all over Africa, regardless. You know, population never mentioned, family planning not included. And they all know individually. You corner them and you say, well, why don't you mention it? They all admit it's true. Of course they do. This silent lie. In the Foreign Office, we used to talk about suggestio falsi and suppressio veri. We never lied. We merely suppressed the truth and suggested the false. And that's what they do, these NGOs. So that's part of the solution as well, I think. Maurice Strong, the first Secretary General of the first Rio Earth Summit 20 years ago, put it very bluntly. You know, this was when it was a legitimate debate. He said, either we reduce our numbers voluntarily or nature will do it for us brutally. That's as elegant a way of putting it as anyone. And if we still ignore it, which we quite likely will, rather a bad picture. Kid with AK. All seen masses of people on television screens with AKs, haven't we? And we've seen masses of hungry people. What's interesting is that I've never seen somebody with an AK looking hungry. It's the people without the AKs that look hungry, because it's a meal ticket. At least that kid's not going to starve. He may have a horrible future in many other ways, but he won't starve, given that piece of hardware. Used to own a couple once. Dreadful. Presents in Vietnam. That's the reason why I do this. I mean, this is a personal note, a confession. It's my favourite person in the world. This is my little granddaughter. And she's the one whose future frightens me. I lie awake at night. So there we are. What are you going to do about it? Well, I'll leave her up there because she's pretty. And the first thing is, everyone can always, at all times, break the taboo. You know, this conspiracy of silence. You'll find most people will agree with you. Just break it whenever it's relevant, verbally and socially. In your own, those of you still of reproductive age, have two or fewer children, is my advice. Many of you will have more than that, will be part of larger families, and I'm not condemning those who do, I'm just pointing out, as it were, now that it might be a good idea. In your support for development NGOs, which I regularly give money, I used to give it to Oxfam, and I've stopped and switched it to Marie Stopes International. I think Marie Stopes do more good than most of the others put together. Save the Children have a very good policy, but they have a new director, and I've had long discussions with him, and he's decided to play this down. You know, he has endless chances to play it up, and he plays it down. Even talking about Niger, amazing, highest growth rate in the world. End the NGO, if you're members of NGOs, and many of you will be, this environmental and development NGOs especially, force them, badger them, make them end the silent lie, just have them say it. Because politicians won't see this population as a variable to be tackled and not just a given to be accommodated until the NGOs lead the way. Once the NGOs have all said radical things for 5 years, brave politicians feel emboldened to say the same, but it doesn't happen the other way around. It's the power of the NGOs and also their weakness. Next one, tell your MPs that you want a UK population stabilisation objective. Lots of MPs seem to think it's just a matter of the third world. It isn't. These 10 more Birminghams in 22 years. The difference, by 2050, the projections are between 2 million and 20 million more Brits. And we're England's the most overcrowded country in Europe. We've got droughts on. We're worried about investment in energy and so on. And water reservoirs. We've done research on all these things and put figures on them as far as we can. But it's very much a UK problem. It's the most overcrowded country in Europe. We are using three-quarters of our renewable ecological services, or as it were, one from abroad or from natural capital. We're only one quarter self-sufficient, according to the Global Footprint Network. And the policy implications of this we can discuss now. I'd rather enjoy it. We have two policies some people like yourselves would jib at. They are forced on us, we believe. One is We should aim for the goal of balanced migration, because we can only have a population stabilisation policy for the UK nationally. There is no prospect of a globally enforceable or applicable policy. So, if we want to stabilise our own numbers and then reduce them to a sustainable level for the sake of our kids, we've got to have balanced migration rather than leaving the tap running while we mop the floor ever more feverishly. And the second one is, which was mentioned already, child benefit. It's ridiculous. It is impossible, logically, to pay child benefit or any kind of child financial public payment for a third and subsequent children if your policy is to stabilise your numbers. So they must be replaced by something else. Child poverty payments when the case is made, but the automatic child payments are out. Those are the two tough policies that we put in our list of otherwise rather bland policy recommendations. And it'll be interesting, this afternoon, I heard people going much more radical stuff than that, like incentives. Incentives do work, and the Indian government, world's biggest democracy, has reintroduced them at a higher level. Incentives for sterilisation, voluntary sterilisation, incentives for vasectomies. And lastly, I'd say think big. The biophysics of the finite planet. I relate everything to my God. I won't flip back to him because you know what he looks like. But I am a metaphysician in a way. I'm a bit of a hedgehog, to my surprise, after all that Foreign Office foxiness. And I do think of the biophysics as being central. There's this wonderful species, comment by Arne Næss, I think, this deep green, gloomy Norwegian, who says man is the only tragic species because it is that same quality, his sublime intelligence, which makes him at once the only species the planet would be better off without and able to appreciate the fact, which I find oddly satisfying. Lastly, I realised, having adopted my God, this really is the end, that but my God bears an uncanny and disturbing resemblance to the God preached by the famous We Free preacher in a sermon recounted to me by a bishop when I was a teenager. And there he is, the We Free man in his church, looking at you miserable sinners. There you'll be, burning in the bottommost pit of hell. And you'll cry out to the Lord, and you'll cry, Lord, Lord, we didn't ken. And the Lord will look down from heaven, and he'll say, well, you ken the new. I'm not sure how much of a joke that is, really. And the very last thing you can do is jolly well join Population Matters. And I've got a number of these forms on the front there, should you wish to join us, and thank you very much. Did I go on far too long? Oh, you've got my mic.
This is the one. No, this one does work. Do we have any time for questions? Guidance, please. No? Well, I'm going to take a couple of questions. Yes? Yes, okay. It was interesting just while people raised their hands.
I'm sorry,
hearing you talking about sexual and reproductive health rights as being a substitute for getting down to the serious business.
That's right.
And now the Vatican is outrightly attacking sexual and reproductive health rights wherever they raise.
That's right.
Because they see it as cover for family planning and abortion.
Indeed.
Right, who's got a question?
Forgive me, could I ask one question first? Because it was a suggestion from the Chief Executive, I think. How many of you basically disagree with him? Because the gentleman up there, I was going to call you anyway, but how many disagree with the point made near the end of the earlier debate we had? I'm just trying to get a show of hands. No, sorry, just in general about the population case. You're one of them, clearly. Okay, fine. Let me call you first then. Thanks.
Right. Okay, question.
Look, I have too many things to say, really. I'm shocked by your racist, colonialist view of the present problems in the world. I come from the third world. I've come from Brazil. We have a problem in Brazil, which is related, for example, to the lack of water in several areas of Brazil. The Amazon forest is, as we all know, in trouble because lots of things are happening there. The devastation of the Amazon forest the lack of water in certain areas of the Amazon forests, ironically, is not caused by the poor people, the small farmers who want to survive. It's caused, hang on a minute, it's caused by big capital, both national and international, related to soya, related to cattle raising. And what are these two products used by Europe, by the United States? I disagree with the fact that you're talking about silence, that there is silence on several groups about the growth of the population. I sort of agree with you. I am not in favor of seeing the population of the world to be 20 million. I'm not. So don't misinterpret me. However, your view, for me, is the old-fashioned view of colonialists who look at the third world and say the problem is the poor and the number of children there. Can I finish? Can I finish? I did not interrupt you, please. Please.
We are very short of time.
Sure, okay. I'll be very briefly.
I think, Roger, can you answer?
25% of the whole consumer in the world is by the rich in the United States and Europe. It is 70% of the consumer in the world. How can you blame these big families? I'm not in favor of
I was
big
not
families.
Blaming big families. I think we ought to move on to the next question.
Why do you blame the third world and families for that? I think it's consumerism by us and by the middle classes in the world.
Thank you very much. I fear you cannot have been listening to the lecture. Is there another question?
Thanks.
Yes, this will have to be the last one, I'm afraid.
Okay. Rajput, I completely disagree with him. I quite agree his point about the effect of our economies and that we're despoiling the world, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't look at the question of population control and that although these people might not consume much resource at the moment, in 20 years' time, if you've got another 2 billion of them, they're going to be consuming more than the United States.
I'm not denying that.
But, sorry, I did have just one question. Your formula, you didn't mention technology. Now, in the 60s, we had the Green Revolution, which sort of doubled productivity in food production, etc. Do you not think there's some scope for mitigating this problem through improved technologies?
Thank you. Yes, of course, technology can help. But there's also, there's Jevons syndrome, Jevons paradox about the economic effects of saving resources, making one thing more resource efficient. You simply sell more of it and it uses resources as much as ever, and they're finite. And the second thing is that the technology I did mention was family planning, which is grossly underfunded. This pathetic, you know, it's available now. We know the answers, as Greg was saying earlier. But yes, the one thing that there isn't a clear view on is, for a techno fix, is energy. Energy is really important. Energy return on energy invested is in steady decline. They first drilled the well in Philadelphia. They probably had a gusher, and it was about 100 to 1. Any gusher land-based oil supplies is a pretty easy, you know, high error-away energy return on investment. But now the tar sands are about 3 to 1. We built our infrastructure at 100 to 1. The poor world are going to have to build theirs on very much lower figures. We're currently running average globally at about between 18 and 12. So this is another problem, again, where there's just far... It's easier to solve every problem, as David Attenborough, our patron, keeps saying. Every problem gets harder and ultimately impossible to solve with ever more people. The sooner we stabilise, the better off our children will be.
Right. Roger, thank you very much indeed for an inspiring, not to worry, inspiring lecture. The thought that I always have first in mind when this subject comes up is that it seems to be the fact that whenever women are educated, they have smaller families. When they're educated, they choose to have smaller families. Right. So... applaud again now to thank Roger. Thank you very much.
that's it. If you'd like to listen to our regular weekly program, just head over to poddelusion.co.uk. There you will also find the other talks from the BHA Conference 2012, including Sir David King and Ben Hammersley. Thanks for listening.